Welcome to the Daily Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. You can, of course, subscribe to us on iTunes, Google Play, Stitcher, all of those places. On our website yesterday, one of our hottest pieces was a joint letter from two former writers for the website Red State. The piece was Why We Are Quitting Red State. It was written by Kimberly Ross and Andrea Ruth, and they join me today on the podcast. Thanks so much.
Thanks for having us.
Yes, thanks for having us.
How's your day been going so far? I mean, considering that you resigned and this all happened. So you guys are okay with all of this?
Yeah, it's actually, I mean, I think that we are, the response has been, you know, primarily positive, and I think our consciences are clear. So it's actually probably a better day today than it has been for the last few when we decided that we were going to do this. So,
okay. So your piece was a manifesto. Begins, for more than a decade, Red State was a solid voice in the world of online conservative commentary. Unfortunately, the allure of Trumpism has left the once great site a shell of its former self. And, of course, a lot of us have experienced the Trumpification of the conservative media. And this is this feels like it's been a long time coming, particularly with Salem owning the website. But before we get into all of that, I just want to just dial it back. You know, I want to start with you, Kimberly. Can you just tell me a little bit about yourself and why you became a conservative and what you were expecting from writing for a site like what Red State?
Sure. Well, I would say that once I got out of college way back in 2004, I was very focused on being like the typical GOP or Republican, very into Fox News and Sean Hannity and O'Reilly and all of that. And gradually, in the years since, I've kind of moved away from that and done, for lack of a better term, a lot of my own independent thinking about the Republican movement and what I wanted to be in relation to that. So definitely have been a conservative and became more so through just years of thinking about the positions and what I really wanted to represent politically. So I do stick to the small government, fiscal responsibility, sanctity of life, all those things. But especially since the era of Trumpism came about, have considered a lot of the current stances and attitudes and actions and words from the Republican Party, and have not been appreciative of what they've said and done, and the kind of behavior that they've modeled for the rest of the country, not to mention the people in their own party. So when I started writing for Red State, it was actually in 2015. I've been there for almost 4 years, but I decided that. Since then, I've decided that it wasn't the place I wanted to be at because of what we said in the piece. It's gone away from what it used to be. But when I started there, I was very excited because it was well-respected and it had a kind of a grassroots hold in the blogging, the conservative commentary world and everything. I was very excited to start. And there was a lot of diversity, actually, on the front page and within, you know, what the other writers would talk about and everything. And one of my biggest issues that I like to talk about is the pro-life movement. And I felt like that was a good place to, you know, have a platform and talk about it. But since then, I've really felt like I've not been able to share my own opinions about Trump because I'm supposed to toe a certain line. So it's been frustrating in recent years.
So, Andrea, a little bit about yourself.
Sure. I'm a little bit older, younger, I mean, than Kim, just by a couple months, though. But I mean, I was raised in the Pacific Northwest, just north of Seattle. So I was raised in a conservative, Christian conservative household, but in a very liberal area. I went to college at in the early 2000s around the whole invasion of Iraq and 9/11 and things like that. Went to a very ultra liberal college, majored in political science and history there, and had to go through that experience of, you know, not really knowing why I was a conservative at that point, still just being, you know, like thinking I knew what I knew from growing up and things like that. But when you go through the political science department at a very progressive school, you end up having to come. I always say I came out of the political science department at Western more conservative than I went in, and more convicted in my conservatism because I had to argue with, for my values mm-hmm. and for the opposite, angle that most of the, kind of socialists, we had one kid in one of my political science courses that was in my same kind of track year. He would sit there and brag openly about how his dad was a part of the Weather Underground back in the day. So, I mean, it was that kind of, constant having to defend yourself and stand up for yourself and know your stuff. And I kind of, again, became more conservative throughout the later Bush years, and then got into blogging. Well, mostly I got into writing, period. I was always on social media and Facebook and driving people crazy on my, Facebook and Twitter, especially family and friends. But then in 2016 or 2015, I was asked to write about the fact that I'm a double amputee and in a wheelchair and write about trans ableism. Because back then it was during the whole like transracial trans ableism, all these different mm-hmm. trans were coming out. And so that's how I first started. I wrote that for the Federalist. And then over the next few, months, I think the following year, Caleb Howe asked me to join Red State. And so I started writing there and learned, a lot about Red State. And I kind of moved up quickly. Kim was always a senior contributor. She was always a contributor, but I went into the editing and the more of the behind the scenes social media side. And there was a structure there. So when you're talking about Red State, not just ideologically, but when they removed any structure of hierarchy last year, when they fired Caleb Howe and several mm-hmm. other writers, that kind of structure and who's calling the shots here, what's our editorial line, went out the window. So that became, kind of like with what we saw the Weekly Standard mm-hmm. happened, there was an argument. It was that it was a more of a disagreement with management. Part of the issue, my issue that I put in there was that there wasn't a breakdown of management in Red State following what we called the purge last year. When everybody, so
let's go back through some of this history, because this all has happened over the last several years. And I think a lot of people, may or may not remember the history. Eric Erickson was the founding editor of Red State. It was a very, very high profile website, and rather famously held an annual Red State gathering. And in was it 2016 when Eric mm-hmm. Erickson
2015
disinvited Donald mm-hmm. Trump from that gathering, after he attacked Megyn Kelly. This seems like a lifetime ago.
It does.
And of course there was huge blowback. Probably is an indication of what was to come. And you point out in your piece, tens of thousands of people canceled their subscriptions to the Red State Morning Briefing, which was the daily newsletter. But you had very high profile editors, Eric Erickson, Leon Wolf, Caleb Howe, and you were able to attract a lot of diverse staffers. Then let's fast forward to what happened in April 2018. First of all, the ownership of Red State shifted. Its parent group, Town Hall Media, which is an affiliate of Salem Media. Tell me again, remind us what happened in April 2018.
The end of April, there was just one normal day when we had a bunch of, writing and posts up and everything. The next morning, all of a sudden, everyone is locked out of the Red State site. We can't log in, can't do anything. Shortly thereafter, we receive emails saying you've either been fired or you've not been fired. And there was an indication that some other people had been fired. And quickly we found out that it was Caleb Howe, who was the editor at the time, who was fired, and several other writers who were not only contributors who did a lot of work, but also people who were most critical of Trump. They were let go without any explanation. And it all happened kind of all of a sudden. And we were basically given no direction after that. We've been kind of on a free-for-all since then. There's been no real leadership and management except from the higher-ups at Salem Media, essentially telling us that we can't really criticize Trump as much as we should because it looks bad or whatever, in no uncertain terms, basically saying that. But it was people who had been there for a while, and yeah, they were let go without any notice.
This was a very high-profile event that was portrayed as a purge of Never Trumpers, or a purge of people who were Trump skeptical. The folks that ran it were pushed back on all of this and said, no, this is not ideological. This is a financial decision. It is not ideological. And they did point out that there were a number of Trump critical writers who remained. You two were not fired. There were others who stayed on. And so at least they preserved, how would you describe it? I mean, like sort of the fig leaf of saying that this was not really a purge of never Trumpers. You people have got that all wrong. But you're saying that there was very clearly the message from what happened in April 2018.
Yeah, it was the unspoken message, because if you looked at and this is not new. I mean, Caleb Howe and Jay Caruso, Ben Howe, all wrote about this at the time, that if you looked at who was left and who was gotten rid of, the high volume writers were gotten rid of, people with high that were being paid more per view, page view, or whatever. It was a mixture, but when you really looked at who was left, it was not the high content production people that were left. So you were left with the high content producers were the clickbait people, the people who went hard for Trump early on, and people who could fill up the front page with, nothing that was going to be critical for Trump just based on what they were writing about. So if you knew all of that, and kind of like paid attention to who, kind of fills the front page at Red State, there's Sarah Quinlan, who also resigned today, but was not an author of our article. She was a one post a day, maybe, probably more like 4 to 5 a week. I think Kim was also about 4 to 5 a week. Before October, I was generally a 1 to 2 to 3 pieces a day, depending on the day. But when you're talking about others who put up 6, 7, 8 posts a day, you get a disproportionate number of articles on the front page. And that was a very, people knew that that would end up being the result. Anybody who was fired or knew how kind of Red State works, because the other thing that people didn't seem to realize about Red State, it had a managing editor with Eric, with Leon, with Caleb. But what it went back to was essentially a traditional blog, where if you were a front page contributor, you had no kind of, there, like I said, it removed the structure. So there wasn't really much, of, hey, you're crossing a line here, you need to take that down, or we're not publishing that. It was very, very rare. Caleb would go in and even Leon and Eric, they would kind of say like, hey, yeah, that's not cool. Or they kind of like keep an eye on certain people. But that went swiftly away, to the point where it was just people would say like, how can you, Andrea, you're one of the editors at Red State. How can you let this go up? And it's like, it's a traditional blog, meaning anybody who has front page keys gets to post whatever they want to. So
hey, let me go to one of the stories that you tell, and you point over the leftover Trump critics wrote fewer entries, and the hostility toward those who still did was palpable. We learned personally that writers who dared to examine President Trump or the MAGA mentality were purposely suppressed in private and even publicly criticized. Okay, so Kimberly, giving you an example of this, you wrote a piece that was critical of some of the Trump supporters' attempts to dismiss the bomb threats. This was just a liberal hoax. They were pretending. Of course, we now know it wasn't, but that was a line for a while. Your piece was, in fact, published. But what happened?
Yes, it was published. And in there, as we all know, I included a tweet talking about all the individuals on the right, more of the Trump backers, who looked at these bomb threats and everything as a hoax, and included like Ann Coulter, Rush Limbaugh, Candace Owens, John Cardillo, Laura Loomer, all of them. And I wrote this piece because it was obviously frustrating to see people just laugh it off because, oh, it's probably a liberal hoax, when it clearly wasn't. So I wrote it and it was published and it went up on the site, but every single contributor gets their piece on the Twitter page and the Facebook page. And I noticed it went up on both of those sites, but then it disappeared. And I thought maybe it was just a fluke. So I actually emailed Andrea and I said, this seems like it's been taken down or accidentally deleted. Could you please repost it on the Twitter page? And she did. And she had to do that, I think, three times because it kept being deleted. And then on the Facebook page, which is obviously where a lot of traffic and clicks come from, it was deleted permanently from there as well. So I was very concerned, obviously, that there was someone higher up taking my post down. And I asked my colleagues about that, and there, you know, was some discussion behind the scenes and that it, you know, wasn't them doing any of it. So essentially, come to find out, it was upper management at Salem taking my piece down. And I was told by upper management to stop discussing it with my colleagues because I should just stop doing that. Essentially because I was critical of Trump backers making light of a situation that we shouldn't make light of. And I was very honest in my piece. And for some reason, it didn't pass the test at Red State because I was being critical of people who unquestionably support Trump and, you know, his allies. So it was kind of the writing on the wall then. Mm-hmm. I mean, I'd felt it before then and everything, but it was the first time one of mine had been taken down because it didn't meet the test.
Okay, now, so this was last October. Now, there have been indications for some time that Salem, the parent company, is that the right way to describe it? I mean, it's mm-hmm. basically Salem runs it all. That they had clearly been putting their thumbs on the scales. Remember back in 2016, we had learned that, and you talk about this in your piece, that Salem told the talk radio hosts, which would include people like Hugh Hewitt and others, to treat Trump more positively. There was actually, I mean, CNN broke this story. The chief executive officer, Edward Atzinger had emailed all of the hosts, emailed Hugh Hewitt, Michael Medved, who was there, to basically make the case that, hey, we ought to get on board Trump and all of this. So and one of the, and of course, this was also when the co-host, you know, was it Alicia Krauss and Ben Shapiro, they were told. Yeah. Yeah, that their show hadn't been in the spirit of supporting the GOP nomination, and Krauss was later fired, and we know what's happened to Michael Medved, who's been replaced with Seb Gorka, which is a decidedly unsubtle move on their part. So
Alicia stipulated she made sure to note to a colleague, she goes, "Fired while pregnant."
So you write, we can no longer support Salem. We feel that remaining at Red State gives the impression we do. Furthermore, we no longer feel as though we can adequately counteract Salem's pro-Trump stance. Now, there will be people who will say, well, what took you so long? This has been around for some time. Was there one, you just described that moment where your piece was essentially being suppressed on social media, but that was back in October. So tell me about the process which you talked to one another and said, this is it, we got to make this move, and we have to do it in a public way.
Well, I think for me, especially since the, quote, purge happened in April, I decided that I was going to stay at Red State and try to essentially fight the uncritical Trump love that was coming forth on the front page every day. I was going to stay and fight by way of writing and pushing back and being honest about what I saw. And it just felt like a losing battle more and more. Like people would write pieces that were dissenting, you know, our pieces. And if we were truthful about something that happened, it was still wrong because it was critical of Trump. And how dare we not hold the GOP water and allow, you know, for all this support to come through without even questioning how it's, if people are going about it or what, you know, the attitudes they're taking. So I really wanted to stay and kind of fight and push back against this. But again, as I think all three of us have felt, that it was a losing battle for quite a while. And we actually had some discussion a week or week and a half ago, and we're all so frustrated with the way the front page was being run and how we just felt we couldn't stand and fight any longer. And so we, decided to all leave at the same time and make a statement of it by letting people know what we were doing. And Andrew, you want to take it from there?
I think, Kim, if we had to kind of put an exact, you know, straw that broke the camel's back on it, it's when, we were all encouraged not to kind of go after each other, town hall, Salem employees, you know, just kind of like, you know, be part of the team, you know, it's a team effort, team group. And, this is all public. It happened on Twitter, so anybody could go and look, but one of the, kind of behind the scenes administrative staff for town hall, started going after Kim for one of her recent posts, regarding wearing partisan apparel to the March for Life, which should be a nonpartisan event. And he started just kind of, and we kind of said that is crossing the line, because this person isn't, you know, an opinion person. He's not a writer. It was something that was so kind of galling of like, wow, like this is, you know, this is someone who's supposed to be kind of impartial to employees, or, and we weren't employees, but impartial to contributors and, you know, like, you know, represent the site as a whole. And it was kind of one of those things where, you know, I stayed on, because I thought the same thing as Kim. I don't believe in giving up your seat at the table. I still consider myself a Republican. While Kim doesn't, I do, because I feel like the only way that we can usher in a transformed Republican Party that is not just a Trump party is for Trump critical people and conservatives to stay in the party. So staying seemed more consistent with that philosophy of mine, that you don't just walk away and have your voice not be heard at all. But that was, for me at least, kind of the thing that said, okay, there is a persistent and prevalent bias towards one, if not a specific writer, then someone, a writer who I agree with on probably 99% of things. Kim and I just have very similar points of view on things. And so, and both have a passion for pro-life issues and things like that. So I like, and I know that Sarah, in the conversations that we all had together, you know, kind of agreed with that, and that looking at the front page was embarrassing and part of the reason why many of us lamented the fact that we weren't posting as often, is because when you see what other people are posting, it makes it hard to want to put your name up on a piece next to a really embarrassing piece. So
let's talk about this, because you're both very strongly pro-life, and of course you're familiar with the argument that if you're pro-life, you need to stay within this particular tribe, that when you criticize Donald Trump, you're undermining the pro-life movement, that any sort of dissent actually empowers the radical left, because it is a binary choice. I'm sure you've heard this over and over again. It's a zero-sum game that if, in fact, you undermine Donald Trump, and you who's been naming pro-life judges to the bench, then what you're doing is you are empowering the other side. Kimberly, how do you respond to that?
Well, I personally would like to see the pro-life community expand and go beyond just it has to be members of the GOP that are included in our fold. I would really like to see more Democrats for Life, because they do exist, people who are secular pro-life, LGBT for life, all these things be included in the pro-life community. And I don't think it does us any good to advance the cause of life, but only say people who supported this president can be involved in it, or people who want to wear this kind of apparel can be involved in it. I want to see that group expand. And that's the only way we could actually attack this issue, I guess, for lack of a better term, is including people who go beyond our specific ideology. We need those who support life, no matter if they are closest to us in you know, political beliefs or not. And I understand that there have been plenty of things that Trump has done, certain executive orders he signed, reinstating the Mexico City policy, or in, you know, reference to other kind of funding. And I really appreciate that. I appreciate nominating Gorsuch and Kavanaugh to the Supreme Court. But making pro-life decisions and moves, I guess, as a president doesn't make you a pro-life president. And I think we have we have such better examples of what the pro-life cause is all about, and kind of an expanded pro-life ethic that is across the board. We have so many more people who can actually take that mantle and run with it. And it was so frustrating to see me be criticized for saying that we shouldn't have partisan apparel at the pro-life march, because we do need to include all this. We're not going to expand and grow and actually combat this culture for death unless we do that. But if I don't support Trump, and I've been told this more than once, if I don't support Trump, then I'm actually not a pro-life person and I shouldn't claim that mantle. And that is ridiculous, because it goes so much further than one president who's only going to be here for one or two terms. And we have to remember that as we go forward, and talk about these issues and look for people to join our movement, because it doesn't do us any good if we only say you have to be one thing or the other.
You know, you're making a point very similar to the one that I think David French made when he was on the podcast. that the pro-life movement is not simply a political movement or a judicial a set of judicial nominations. It's ultimately going to be won or lost in the culture. And the danger mm-hmm. of making it excessively partisan is that you may have these short-term victories at the cost of losing the long-term cultural struggle, which is really, you know, hearts and minds struggle, getting people to believe this is fundamentally wrong, getting young women and young men to make the decision to choose life. And every time that the movement basically joins itself with this partisan political movement in this particular moment, it undermines the ability to make that longer term case. But that tends to get lost. You also make the point, I wanted to get your take on this. In your article, you talk about, and this is something that I think a lot of us wrestle with, is what's happened to evangelical Christianity in this age. You said it's hard not to note the irony that Salem Media, a company that targets direct audiences interested in Christian and family themed content and conservative values, that it threw its full support behind Donald Trump, a thrice married lying philanderer who utilized bankruptcy laws and debt to con tenants and contractors out of their money. Salem now promotes anyone who is pro-Trump, even if those people gleefully flout Christian principles. For example, Salem radio host Eric Metaxas recently hosted far-right provocateur Milo Yiannopoulos, and you quote Andrew Eggers' piece, who chronicled what that was all about. So what is your take on Christians who feel that they need to line up with Donald Trump or that they are prepared to give him mulligans for his personal conduct? Because this is another one of these long-term cultural fights where you wonder what sort of damage the church is doing to itself by making these compromises. Andrea, do you want to take this one?
Sure. I'll probably let Kim kind of touch on it as a Christian, because I'm not one, but just okay. as someone who grew up in a conservative Christian household and grew up listening to, you know, James Dobson, who also, you know, called Donald Trump a baby Christian and kind of gave, you know, a sign of approval to a lot of evangelical Christians. When James Dobson did that, it was very upsetting to me just because I grew up listening to Focus on the Family every day. And, you know, it's one of those things for me, it's very disheartening because I think it turns a lot of people off. And, you know, the head of the Christian Coalition during the Donald Trump, the 2016 mm-hmm. election said there is no Christian Coalition anymore. Mm-hmm. So, I think that it's really undermined, you know, Christian values as far as how you say that you're voting for, you know, you're a Christian, so you're voting Republican. When you're voting for someone like Donald Trump, you really lose your ability to kind of point fingers at Democrats and say Democrats bad, Republicans good.
Yeah, one of the most frustrating things I've seen in the last few years is the tendency on the right to conflate Christianity and the GOP as if they're one and the same. And if you support one, you should instantly support the other. As someone who grew up in an evangelical household, my father was a pastor. He's currently a missionary. I don't see the attitudes, actions, and behaviors of Donald Trump and plenty of people who support him unquestioningly. I don't see that reflecting Christianity. I can't support so many things that Donald Trump has said. And I think he should be called out for his lack of example, just as a, you know, Republican. But as far as the Christianity angle is concerned, I have not seen this man exhibit any sort of faith. I obviously don't know his heart, but I don't believe he's a man of faith. And for us to say, well, he's a Republican, so that means he's an example for the Christian community and we should support him no matter what. That, like you said, that doesn't help us in the long run. It may help us, you know, currently with the next election or something and bring short-term gains, but that doesn't help us as we want to impact the culture. And I can't understand why anyone would believe he's an example when he's clearly shown the opposite. And if these same behaviors and words and actions were done by someone on the left side of the aisle, I mean, we would not wait to call them out and say that their behavior is wrong. But for some reason, just because he's a Republican, we're okay with it. I think that does a great disservice to of course, the conservative side and the Christian side.
Well, it's going to be interesting next year, because I see that there are some conservatives who are trying to make an issue of, you know, Kamala Harris's personal life. It's hard for me to imagine how a Republican Party that has embraced Donald Trump is going to make her relationship with Willie Brown a central issue. So let's go back to this issue of red state and your decision to resign. Of course, the argument that you might hear from the red state folks or from other people in conservative media, well, you have heard these arguments, is that, look, this is a business decision because the audience of conservative media, you know, is demanding that conservative media be a safe space, that it be a pro-Trump pro-Trump space. And so the question is there in fact a market for the kind of commentary that you were engaging in? You know, wasn't the management in some ways reflecting that every time they put one of your posts up that's ripping Donald Trump or suggesting that you not wear a MAGA hat to the pro-life movement, they got blowback. They got criticism on social media. They heard from their people that this is not what they were coming from. So I guess the question is, to what extent is the conservative media simply following what the conservative consumer wants as opposed to it being a top-down diktat?
It does seem that the what the conservative crowd as a whole or Republican crowd as a whole wants is mostly Trump cheerleading in the columns and everything they see online. But I think, as we've talked about, that this Trump era is short term, and we have to think in, you know, terms of, you know, the long term effects on everything. And even if people don't really crave the kind of stuff we write and the criticism, the measured criticism that we offer, we do have to like scoop out a niche for ourselves, because we need to establish ourselves as people who will criticize our own or people who are closer to us on the other side. Because, you know, like we said, this isn't going to last forever. And I think we'll all have to look back on this era when there was a lot of compromises made and decide where we stood. And I think right now I would like to stand as someone who is criticizing when needed and pushing back against the greater whole, even if it shoves a lot of criticism my way. And I have no problem doing that.
So far, since the piece was released about 10 o'clock on Thursday, what kind of reaction have you gotten, Andrea and Kimberly?
Originally, you know, I think a lot of people, what I've seen is, at least initially, was a lot of people being supportive and saying, wow, you know, you know, well done for, you know, kind of like taking a economic hit and, you know, possibly a hit to your reputation and things like that to leave, you know, Red State and a site that you've, you know, stayed with and tried to help as much as possible, you know, that you, you know, have moved on to, you know, trying to say this site has a cancer in it that's not able to be fixed. And I don't think that it's interested in restoring any of its integrity. I think that there are some people, there are definitely writers left there who are absolutely, you know, smart and sharp commentators and want the site to be better. But especially, you know, a lot of the people who have been there for a while. But when it comes to what it seemed to happen was over the next few hours, and I think Kim kind of agreed with me on this, I kind of noticed like, oh, the Trump supporters have now like somehow gotten marching orders or have somehow finally kind of gotten wind of this article and the whole like, oh, bye Felicia type responses. And who are you? Why should we care? Dude, you follow me. I don't know why you should care, but you follow me. So you can unfollow me, I guess. But it took a couple hours for there to be really some negative stuff. But again, that's one wonderful thing about social media is you can, you know, mute it and turn it off. So
have you gotten any pushback from some of your colleagues? I mean, when you take a step like this, obviously you're going to get a lot of attention, but you're also going to disappoint some folks.
As far as from colleagues at Red State, haven't seen anything vicious from them. We've received a lot of, at least I have, some best wishes, even if they don't agree with us completely in general or don't agree with the content of the article at the Bulwark. They, you know, have been pretty nice to us and everything. So that's good to see. And as far as just general blowback, I've I've received a lot of like kudos and cheers and props to you, even if we don't always agree on the issues. Appreciate the stance you're taking, even though it's not the easiest right now, it's probably the best for you in the long run. So I've been pretty pleased with your reaction.
So what do you think you're going to be doing now? What happens to you?
I will continue to write at Washington Examiner, and I'm about ready to start as a contributor at ARC Digital. So looking forward to getting more work out there. That's just critical of people who need to be chastised.
and Andrea?
I'm in the works of starting to probably do some volunteer work for getting to be more well-known site. They have reached a point where they aren't, you know, they don't have a ton of money, but they are needing some kind of project management to get their editorial type and just kind of like payment management and writing management and publishing management. So I'll be, I love project management and things like that. So I'm going to be hopefully building my resume, volunteering, not getting paid. I'm blessed enough to be able to do that right now. So I'll be just kind of sitting back in the background, probably publishing, you know, articles when something strikes me. When I first started writing, I was writing about things that really mattered to me that I had thought out well. And it's been, you know, writing at Red State, you were often, you know, writing on the fly, writing about breaking news. And so you weren't really able to get too incisive on things, especially if you were writing about anything that was timely. So I'm looking forward to kind of sitting back and getting back into my kind of political science background of thinking about things more and and reading more, definitely reading more. So, yeah.
Say the last line of your piece is, we publish this with the hope that it serves to push the Republican Party and conservative media back to the ones we respected, admired, and believed in. How optimistic are you that that's going to happen anytime soon, Kimberly?
I don't think it'll happen anytime soon, but I think for the conservative world and Republicans in general to learn their lessons, it's going to take some pain. And if that's losing an election or articles such as this, then so be it. But I hope we get someday back to the healthy kind of commentary in Republican world that, you know, it used to be.
Kimberly Ross, former Red State senior contributor, Andrea Ruth, former Red State contributing editor. Appreciate it very, very much. Both of you can read the full piece up at the Bulwark, Why We Are Quitting Red State. Thank you, both of you. And thank you for listening to the Daily Bulwark podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. We'll be back tomorrow and we'll do this all over again.